This is episode 16 of season 4 of The Bad Apples. This is the Slackware Special. About a year ago, maybe, I don't know, maybe more, Linux Reality, Chess Griffin's Linux Reality, did a special episode on Slackware. Back then, I think it was at version maybe 11, maybe 12, and so by now, it's a little bit out of date. Not that out of date, because not that much has changed, but there are a couple of updates in Slackware 13 that I think warrant another sort of special episode by someone on how to install Slackware and kind of how to get it set up and configured so that it's a great system for you, the user. The reason someone might consider using Slackware, I mean, I assume that if you've just heard that message, you've either turned this episode off, and so if you're continuing to listen, you're probably already a little bit interested in maybe trying out Slackware at some point. So I'm not going to go too far into why you might want to try it. I'm a horrible salesperson anyway, so for me, the reason that I guess I've stuck with Slackware all this time, and I guess you could argue that it was my first distro, so it's kind of like the one that I know and love or whatever, but I think more than that, Slackware, more than any other Linux system that I've really ever used, you just really know what's going on your system almost all the time. And this isn't just because it was my first distro and I'm familiar with the way they do things. It's actually more of the fact that Slackware keeps the user, the main user, you, the person who owns the computer and kind of maintains it, in charge or in control. So if you're using a Slackware system, chances are that a lot of the major applications and libraries and things like that, that you're using on a daily basis, you've gone to the trouble of installing a lot of that stuff. You've actually had some involvement in making it all happen. This is not necessarily the case for something like, any other one with one of the package managers that almost does too much for the user. And while a good package manager is a pleasant thing to have, and Slackware has one good one and another sort of extra one, so I mean it's got two great package managers in my view. But there are other package managers out there, like, you know, the whole RPM thing and the whole aptitude thing and all those different variations and similar things. They do almost too much, I think, by letting you install things and then pulling down dependencies. And, I mean, I guess sometimes I look at the dependencies being pulled down when I'm, you know, doing a yum install, whatever, on Fedora. Sometimes I'll look and see, okay, well, what exactly am I getting when I say yum install free talk, you know? Do you look at the things that it's in addition to the application that you're trying to install? Not usually. On Slackware, you kind of have to, because it's part of the job. It's part of how you install software. So, in a sense, I really do like that. It is kind of what I'm used to from back when I was using only the Unix side of OS X back in the old days, when I was living in X11, basically, the X11 environment on OS X, installing things from source because that's all I could do to get things that were Unix-based applications running on the computer. So I'm just kind of used to having to deal with finding the dependencies and installing them and making sure that it all kind of works together. Is this the easiest and quickest way to install software? No, probably not. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's just remarkably pleasant and you need something, and so you open up SBOPKG and install something, and it's done just as quickly as a yum install would be. Sometimes it takes longer. Sometimes it takes even longer because you have to modify a make file or look around and see what environment variable is not set properly, that sort of thing. So I'm not going to say that there's no extra work in Slackware. There is a little bit of extra work in Slackware, but the extra work in my mind makes the system a lot more predictable and it makes it make more sense, and I think it makes it more stable because you're really careful about what you put on there, or at least I am. So those, I guess, are sort of the reasons that come to mind in terms of why I use Slackware. So And I guess the other reason that one might want to look at Slackware, I know I said I wasn't a very good salesperson, I'm probably not, but I guess I just can't help but mention it. I mean, the other reason is that it's a good learning system, and the lessons that you learn on Slackware do carry over onto other Linux distributions. For instance, let's say that I loaded GPM, the mouse driver for the text console. I think it's GPM. Yeah, let's call it GPM. Let's say I installed that during my install of Slackware, and then later on I decide, I need to get rid of this, which is exactly what happened. You are forced to go in and figure out how to get that GPM driver not to load on boot, on startup. And you learn how to do that, and you learn, okay, well, here you go into Etsy, /etc/rc.d and find the shell script that launches GPM, and you move that out of that directory, or you comment it out, or however you want to do it. Now you've learned how to do it on Slackware. Well, someone comes to you with an Ubuntu system or a Fedora system, and they say, this thing keeps turning on when I start up, and I really want it to stop. How do I do that? Well, you won't know any of the GUI tools for that. You won't know the sysvnet or whatever it was for Fedora, or however you do it on Ubuntu services manager or whatever. But what you will know to do is go to the Etsy directory and find either RC or init folders and look around and see where these scripts that are starting services are kept, and then you'll know, okay, I probably either have to comment it out or move it out of that directory, or just all these different things that you can do with these kind of startup and shut down commands. The concept is very, very similar. If you had learned how to do that on an Ubuntu system or a Fedora system with the GUI tools they give you, that's all you would ever know. You wouldn't even know that it was kept in the /etsy directory, So there's a kind of beauty to the, I guess, the raw power of Slackware, as well as the responsibility of maintaining a Slackware system, that I think is very, very helpful. Convinced, you're going to go use Slackware on all your systems. Great. How do you do it? Well, okay, so the first thing that you are going to want to do is consider which version of Slackware you want. Slackware 13, obviously, but which version of 13? One of the big things with 13 was the, it's got 32-bit, but then it's also got a 64-bit version. So you kind of want to think about which of those two you want to run. Running 64-bit could make you run into some problems in terms of complexity that you may or may not want to add to your daily computing. So compiling one is an issue. Trying to go out and just finding pre-compiled binaries, will probably be an issue. So far I've run into some printer driver issues. There are Linux drivers out there for this printer, but it's 32-bit only, so it's not working on my 64-bit platform. An issue with, well, for instance, if I wanted to go grab a Blender pre-compiled binary, well, actually I could for Blender because they do provide 64-bit, but Keltex, the screenwriting program, I was trying to grab that pre-compiled binary for 32-bit, and that wasn't working very well either. So, again, there are probably hacks around these issues that I either don't know or that I don't care to attempt right now because it's not that much of an important issue. Even so, it's still an extra layer of complexity that you may or may not realize you're getting yourself into by going 64-bit. So be aware of that. Make that choice. Slackware 13 itself has lots of new things. It's got KDE4 by default, the desktop, although, of course, you can choose any desktop you really want. And then there's a lot of new technology in it, like, the new X driver, or, X.org, X server, 7.4 or whatever it is. It uses a lot of HAL stuff so that you aren't really doing as much with the zorg.conf as before. That's kind of good and kind of bad, I think. I mean, some people love HAL, some people hate it, some people don't know what it is. I used to not like it that much. I've really kind of started to adapt to it. I'm getting used to it. And again, demonstrating how handy Slackware is sometimes, when I first put it on one of my MacBooks, this was before the official release, it was it didn't know what to do with the touchpad on my MacBook. So I had to learn about policies, HAL policies. So I learned about that and wrote, or actually copied and pasted one for my touchpad, put it where it was supposed to go, and so on and so forth, and finally I had a working touchpad. But I think HAL, in the worst case, doesn't work, and you have to figure something out. But you'd have to do that anyway if you're Zorg, you know, if you were doing Zorg.conf, you'd probably have to figure all that stuff out anyway. So that's not that bad. And then in the best case scenario, it just detects what you've got, and everything magically works. So in the case of Slackware 13, everything magically worked on my MacBook. So if you're thinking about putting Slackware 13 on either a white or black MacBook, I can say with a fair amount of certainty that it's going to work quite well, and almost everything works out of the box. Everything that I've really bothered trying. Touchpad has multi-touch out of the box. The sleeping and waking issue is a non-issue. It works perfectly. The only issue was that the video driver needed to be rolled back. So there's a new Intel driver, or there's a bug between Intel video cards like 945 or 965, whatever that horrible graphic chip is that really shouldn't even be in computers anyway. It's so underpowered, but I digress. So that chip and the latest Xorg driver for it got some kind of bug between those two things, and they're working to fix it, so it's not a Slackware-specific issue, it's just a driver issue, I guess. So I think by default, Slackware 13 wants to install the latest video driver, 2.8.3, and then what you need to do is remove that and install 1.6.3, I think it is. So we'll go over that in a little while, but that was about the only thing that really gave me any kind of issue on the MacBook. Otherwise, everything works great out of the box. Sound, headphone, microphone. I didn't try the webcam yet, but I have had that working before, so I don't see why it wouldn't work. I don't think that it was out of the box functionality, but again, I haven't really tried, so I could be wrong. Okay, so once you've decided whether you want the 32-bit or the 64-bit, you can go get the ISO, torrent it, or purchase it from Slackware.com. The purchase, you get the 32-bit and the 64-bit. It's a dual-sided DVD, so one side has the 32-bit, one side has the 64-bit. You can also get things like the Slackware Essentials book, which is kind of the original Slack book. It's a really, really handy little book, so I highly recommend it. You can get hats and shirts and things like that. All the money, from what I understand from the store, goes to support the project, so it's kind of a good thing to do. Once you've got that, you'll have a DVD that you will then burn, or you'll have an ISO, rather, that you will burn onto DVD. There are basically two choices. You get a DVD, or you get a USB boot image, which is a really, really small boot image, but I think you have to have like a Pixie server set up and stuff like that, and I've never done that before, so I want to sometime, but I have not done that yet, so I don't know anything about that. If that's what you're going to do, go for it, but otherwise, just probably getting the DVDs, your best bet. And the DVD is worth having. I mean, it's got everything you could ever want on it in terms of software. And then you've got the Slack book on there, and you've got an extra directory with extra things that you might need to install, like older video drivers or Wicked, the wireless network manager. So there's a lot of cool extra things on there that actually you might want. Okay, so finally, we've got the DVD. It's burned. We boot, right? Well, almost. One thing that you have to remember about the DVD, or rather some of the setup tools, is that there's not really a super easy way to resize partitions. So you are going to probably want to do that before you boot into this image. There's a way to do it from within the bootable disk. I have not really bothered trying. I think it would be done with, well, a combination of FDisk and resize 2FS, but I've never really done that. But if you're going to do that, if you're going to have like Fedora on one partition, Slackware on the second partition, then you'll want to install, or rather take care of your resizing of the partitions from within your other environment, I think. That would be easiest. That's what I would recommend. So after you've done that, then you can boot from the DVD. And the first screen you see on the DVD, and don't worry, I'm not going to do like a screen-by-screen walkthrough of the install. That's Chess Griffin did that sort of in his how-to, so in his Slackware special. So you've got a lot of that there. But, I mean, the Slackware installer, as you will find, is extremely, extremely intuitive. If you can read the screen, you can install Slackware. I think a lot of people who gripe about the Slackware installation process just don't bother reading what the screen is telling them, because it's very, very clear. So when you first start up, the thing that throws, I guess, a lot of people off is it doesn't just boot to an installer. And, you know, it's not a big graphical installer. It's not even an incursus installer. It's just a text screen asking you to boot a certain kernel. And people probably skip over this and then skip over every other screen following, but if you read it, again, you'll get all the information that you need. So it turns out that when you first boot Slackware, you want to choose which kernel you want to boot with. So the default kernel is huge-smp.s. If you're on an older system, so if you don't have a Pentium Pro processor or above, then you're going to want to use the huge.s kernel. That will support i486 and better on single CPU machines. And then, aside from that, if you need something, if you can't see the installer, so you need to hear the installer, you can use the speakup kernel, which is speakup.s. And you can find all that information out by hitting F2, and that will give you all the information I just gave you. So after you select your kernel, it boots, and then again, still not in the installer, it gives you a screen of text saying that you need to, well, first log in as root, then take care of your partitions, and then start the installer. So, in order, first you log in as root. That's easy. You just type root and log in. Now you've got a root prompt. And then you can choose either fdisk or cfdisk. So fdisk is, it's a good program, but it's kind of, you have to kind of know how to use it a little bit. So what I usually do is I just use cfdisk because I'm not really that familiar with fdisk, and I always end up having to go, you know, fdisk-m for the menu or the help, whatever it is. And so I'm always doing that, so that gets kind of tedious. So I just use cfdisk, which is a menu-driven partitioning tool anyway, so that's what I do. To get there, you type in cfdisk /dev/sda. Probably SDA. SDA, of course, is, I think, what, the SCSI emulator for the IDE interface or something like that. So that's what drive you're probably pointing cfdisk to, because that's probably going to be your main drive. If it is not, then you will probably find it on, for instance, /dev/HDA. But I think on most systems, it's going to be SDA, because that's your main, you know, the first drive on the first bus of your computer. For hard drives, that's usually IDE. So you do cfdisk /dev/SDA, hit return, and you get, like I say, a little menu-driven thing, which shows you the current partitions at the top of the screen and a little menu at the bottom that you can arrow through with right or left arrows. So if you've got, let's say, one hard drive that is 100 gigabytes, the first thing that you'd want to do Well, the first thing you'd want to do is delete all the current partitions. If there's partitions there and you're going to write over them, just delete them. If you're not going to write over them, if you've already set up a partition, then we'll assume that you see, let's say, again, just a 100 gigabyte partition of free space. So you want to create that free space into a partition. So you go down at the menu at the bottom. There's a selection for new. You hit return for new, and then you want it to be a primary partition rather than a logical one. And you can dictate what size you want this partition to be in megabytes, where you want to start the partition from, and that's usually from the beginning of that free space. And that's it. You've just made a little partition. We will give it a bootable flag, which you will see after you've made the partition. You can just hit return for bootable. And then you can also define it as a certain type of partition. And this, again, is in the menu at the bottom of the screen. But you go to type, and it gives you a big long list of all the different partition types available to you, with 83 being Linux and 82 being Linux swap. So just make that Linux, which is 83, and then the rest of the free space, let's say it's 5 gigs or something, we'll say that is swap, so we'll make that a new partition, we'll make it primary at the beginning of the partition, we'll use up all the space available to us, and then we'll go down and say, okay, make it the type 82. So now I've got two partitions. I've got a primary Linux partition at 95 gigs, and I've got a primary Linux swap partition at 5 gigs. And then you're ready to write that out to the partition table. So again, with the menu, you hit write. It warns you that it's about to write over the partition table of your disk. Do you really want to do that? Yes, you do. if you haven't backed up and stuff like that, you obviously shouldn't even be here at all. So hopefully you've backed all your data up and you're ready to do this for reals. Of course, technically speaking, it's just the partition table. You could probably go and rescue data even after you've done that, but again, you should be backed up at this point, so hopefully you are. So then you quit CF disk, and that's the end of CF disk. Your partitions are ready to go. It takes you back to your root prompt, and you can type in setup. It gets you into the installer proper. This is the incursus-based, menu-driven installer for Slackware. If you've ever installed Debian, this is going to be vaguely familiar. It's unique, it's different, but it's similar. And again, reading the screen really, really helps. So the first screen that you see is just kind of the main menu. And it's got about, 8 little subdivisions. There's the help, the key map, adding swap, target, source, select, things like that. And once you get into the flow of this, you won't come back to this main menu unless you, like, cancel what you're doing. So it's going to take you through the entire install, which is nice. So the key map I already set when I first booted, I set it as English or whatever. So the first thing we want to do is add swap. So you hit return on add swap, and it auto-detects the swap partition, because we defined that swap partition as a swap partition in CFdisk. So it auto-detects that, and you can just say to use that partition as your swap. It will offer to check for bad blocks. I do that if it's a new computer and I've never done anything with it before, whatever. I don't do it after I've kind of gotten used to a computer and feel pretty confident that it's an okay computer. So the next thing, like I say, it's not going to take you back out to the main menu. It's just going to keep going through all the menus. So the next step would be your target partition. And sure enough, after you add swap, it takes you to the target partition screen. Again, I've defined only one partition as a Linux partition, so I'm going to select that, and it will offer to format that partition or not. I will format that partition, and it will also ask you what file system type you want. So, of course, there's ext2 and 3 and RiserFS, XFS and JFS, and then new to Slackware 13 is ext4. So I go ahead and use ext4 because I figure that's the latest and greatest, most exciting new file system out there. Going to transition smoothly into ButterFS, so I go ahead and use ext4. So it partitions that for me, and then you get to install. And then you get to choose what packages you actually want to install on the system. Now, this is divided up into a series of sort of groups, which I guess originally was probably because that was, you know, when you were making your floppies to install 33 floppies or whatever, they wanted to divide it into the different groups that you needed to install certain packages. The K set, which would be the kernel, sources, and E for Emacs. I think they just call the KDE1 KDE, things like that. So it still serves as a fine little way to subdivide everything up into categories. And you can choose to install certain categories or just exclude an entire category. Like if you just know you're never going to use Emacs, then you could exclude the E category. Or if you know that you don't want X-based games, then you could exclude all the X games, or KDE, if you wanted to exclude that. If you just knew that you didn't want the KDE libs or KDE, you could exclude that and go with whatever else you wanted to use. So I used to do that, actually, the KDE one, back when it was, the ISO was 12.2. The current version of Slackware was really what was going to become 13, and that's what I was running. So a good way to get KDE 4 before 13 was out was to install 12.2 without any of the KDE or KDE lib packages, and then set your Slack package mirror to the current folder and install KDE from there, and that would give you KDE 4 on a 12.2 system, or rather, technically, I guess, a dash current system, but it was from the 12.2 ISO, is my point. So the point is, I guess, that you can exclude packages from being installed. Now, the next screen after that is going to be whether you want to, and again, I'm kind of going from memory here, I'm not doing this step by step, but you'll see it when it comes up. Eventually, it's going to ask you how you want to install the packages that you've chosen. And there's the full install, and then there's like a guided install sort of thing, where you can actually go through and choose which applications from those package groups you want to have installed. I highly recommend this because you really get to see exactly what's going on in your system. You can also exclude the things that you just know you're never going to use. And I did that, especially when I was installing Slackware on my Triple E PC. It's fine to get the big Slackware install on a computer with, you know, 120 gigabyte hard drive or 300 gigabyte hard drive or even 80 gig hard drive, really. I mean, we're still only talking about, what, 4, 5, 6 gigs, whatever. The Triple EPC, having far less memory, I would go through and kind of select all the little packages that I just knew I wasn't going to need to install. So that's a good option to have. But regardless of what computer you're putting this on, it is kind of a good idea to specify what specifically you do or don't want, because you're looking at it. But even beyond that, I mean, no matter what computer you've got, it's a good idea to do the menu install, because that way you get everything, you get to see everything going on in your system. It's just kind of educational, basically. Now, there's also a newbie version as well. This is a frightening, frightening thing. I did it once back when I was a newbie, and it really is good, and I almost recommend it. I think everyone should do this once as well. I mean, not necessarily, but if you want to really, really get an idea of what goes into a Linux system, the newbie install is great, because it literally takes you through every possible package that it's going to install. It's kind of frightening. It's just every single thing that you could ever install on here, you go through. Just every library, every everything. I could be exaggerating a little bit, but they themselves exaggerate a little bit as well. They say that the X series takes a year to get through, so, and I believe it. I remember it taking a very long time. But it is, like, again, kind of cool, because you see everything and you come out really, really knowing a lot more about Linux and what makes a Linux system run. So after you choose the packages, or you just choose a full install, whichever you're doing, after you do that, it'll start installing everything, and it takes a while to install, because it's not, I mean, everything is on the ISO as a compressed little package, so it has to uncompress everything and then install it, so it does take a little while. I think the fastest install I've ever seen, just in general, is the Fedora Live KDE install that I do. That thing just goes right through it, because I guess what it's just basically literally copying everything on the disk to the computer, and that's what it does. It's a very fast install. This one is a fairly long one, because, like I say, the packages are sitting there on the disk, they're compressed, they need to be uncompressed, you know, unarchived, uncompressed, and then installed. So it does take a while, especially if you're doing a full install, because again, you're doing an install of everything that they offer, which is cool, but might take a little while. So point is, go get a cup of coffee.
Can we talk about the new search of computers?
Can we talk about multiprocessing?
Can we talk about Beowulf clusters?
Can we talk about Web 2.0?
Just talk geek to me.
Just talk geek to me.
Hey, it's Steve Geek. Please come check out my podcast for my take on all things geeky. You can find us at www.talkgeektome.us. That's www.talkgeektome.us. Thank you.
Just talk geek to me.
You come back from your cup of coffee, the thing's installed, and now you still have work to do. One of the things that you have to do, I think, is configure your network. You can save that for later, or you can configure your network. All the usual rules apply. You know, you want to name your network and kind of want to give it the same name as everything else that's on your network, probably, so that you can kind of do the whole SSH thing over to another computer easily without having to worry about, does it have the same domain name and stuff like that. So configure your network or not. You want to choose your default X environment. Again, the default is KDE, but you've got XFCE on there. You got Fluxbox. I think you have Blackbox, or maybe that's in the extras directory. But you have FW, F, what is it, FVWM, lots of different environments to choose from. So do that. And of course, you can always change that later as well. I mean, all this is doing is setting the system-wide default of StartX, but you can always customize that with a .xinitrc file in your home folder. And then you are going to want to set a root password. So you set the root password, and then it tells you that you're ready to reboot. So you reboot. When you reboot, the CD should pop out, and you can stash it. But we're going to need it in a moment, probably. Keep it around, because we're going to use it for some examples of install PKG and stuff. So the first thing that you do once your new Slackware system has booted is you're going to want to add some users. And Slackware comes with a handy little script called add user. This is similar to user add, but it is not user add. It's not user add, it's add user. So user add, of course, is just the default application on, I think, all the Linux systems on how to add a user, and it can be scripted and it can be great. But add user is a more friendly version of that. It just kind of, it steps through, okay, what do you want the real name to be, the username, the password, all the extra information, like telephone number, work number, room number, all that stuff. So that's kind of a nice little way of using, of adding users. It also, in Slackware 13, it gives you some options about, like, the initial groups that you want the user to be a member of. So there's the users group, which is, I guess, the default group for the users. But then you can also add them to audio and video and floppy and CD-ROM and all the different groups that kind of will make the user feel like it's a normal computer, like doing things that a normal user would usually be able to do, plugging in a USB key and actually reading the files and or a CD-ROM or whatever. Mightn't you want a user not to have to be a member of these groups? Yeah, quite possibly. It depends on, you know, who the user is. So for me, myself, I make a couple of users. I also make a guest account so that when someone wants to use my computer for something, I can switch them over to a guest account so that they can't screw up my environment. This guest account, I do not put them in the users group at all. I make them a custom group. And then I also do not put them in any extra group. I don't put them into the audio or the, well, no, I put them in audio and video. That's true. But I don't put them in the CD-ROM or the floppy or the plug and play or, you know, all these different groups that I just don't think that a guest account is really going to need and probably shouldn't have anyway. So that's kind of a cool way of managing other users and stuff. So an add user script, you just type in add user and then you add your user. So of course, remember that all your users should be the same on, you know, if you've got two computers and you are yourself and you want to be using both computers, you should make the username just to make your user experience a lot smoother, make your username the same on both systems. So if I'm Klaatu on my Slackware system, I want to be Klaatu over on, you know, my Fedora system as well, and my other Slackware system on my triple EPC. So, you know, the same username will help you when you're trying to transfer files or SSH into the other box or whatever. What you also need to be aware of is Fedora, for instance, starts users out at 500 for their UID. And you can find out your UID by typing in ID, and it'll tell you what number you are as a user. So Fedora starts you out at 500 by default. Slackware starts you out at 1,000. I'm not sure what other Linux distributions do. I haven't checked lately. But this could sometimes complicate matters. So what I typically do, or what I've done for a while now, is since I knew that my user ID on Slackware was 1,000, every time I install Fedora, I give myself a custom user ID number of 1,000. That way, I'm not only Klaatu UID 1,000 on Slackware, but I'm Klaatu UID 1,000 on Fedora as well. So that helps a little bit, I think. Once you have your users created, then probably what you're going to want to do is actually su, return, and then enter your root password. So now we're root again. And the reason we're doing root again is because we want to play around with the package manager. So you're probably thinking, package manager? I thought Slackware didn't have a package manager. Yes, that is one of those myths that just doesn't seem to ever go away. Slackware's package manager is called SlackPKG. It is absolutely a normal package manager. If you've ever used a package manager on Linux before, or even like on OpenSolaris, or probably FreeBSD, you have absolutely basically used Slack PKG. And it is only available to you as root. So if you're not root and you're trying to do Slack PKG, you're not going to find that it actually works. So first you need to install, you need to set up Slack PKG. The way you do that is you vim slash etsy slash Slack PKG slash mirrors. That will open up in vim the slash etsy slash Slack PKG slash mirrors file, which is a file just full of mirrors for your repository. You only need to choose one repository. It's not like Debian where you've got Debian security main, Debian contrib free main, contrib non-free main, you know, all that stuff. It's just one FTP server off in the sky somewhere that you need to choose. You do want to make sure that you're choosing it for the right version of Slackware. So right now you're running 13. So if you go and find 13, you can find one in your local area more or less and uncomment in whatever protocol you want to use, FTP or HTTP. I've never used the HTTP because I'm never behind like some weird firewall. I'm assuming that's why they give you the choice. But if you can't get out to FTP, then you can uncomment HTTP. But I just do the FTP on the East Coast now, so that's what I do. If you're on 64-bit, make sure that you're doing it for Slackware 13 64-bit and not the 32-bit one. So you want to make sure you're doing the right one. You also have the option of going current, of running Slackware current, which simply means that you're, instead of looking at a sort of a preserved, frozen-in-time archive of everything that is Slackware 13, you're looking at a directory, at a server that is constantly getting updated and changed and added to and stuff like that, as Patrick Volkerding and the Slackware team, I guess, comes up with new things for the next release of Slackware. So whatever the next one's going to be, whether it's 13 or 14 or 13.1 or whatever, the thing that is being worked toward becoming that is Slackware current. So that's kind of the rawhide folder, you know, if you're in Fedora terms. So if you uncomment something for Slackware 64 current or Slackware dash current, then you are going to be updating off of the current folder, the current server, and you can run the latest and greatest things out there. Do I do this on my system? Yes, eventually I do. But since right now I am using 13 and it just came out and stuff like that, I don't really bother. I'm just using the 13 server. Eventually, when I start feeling that old familiar itch that I want new packages, new updated versions of this or that, yeah, I'm going to switch over to current. That's typically, I guess, since 12, that's pretty much how I've done it. From 12 up to now, I guess. So 12, 12.1, 12.2, and 13, that's what I've done. I just, you know, stayed with the version on the label of the ISO for a little while, and then towards the end switch over to current. But whatever you choose, it doesn't really matter. Well, it does matter, but it doesn't matter to me, so do what you want to do. Slack package mirrors, only uncomment one of them, and the rest of them you can leave commented out or delete them or whatever you want to do. Okay, so now you've set your little repository, so you still as root, you want to type in slack pkg space update, and that will rsync the list of applications from the server, you know, from the repo you've just chosen down to your computer. And if you wanted to go ahead and upgrade everything to whatever is on the server, you can do a slack pkg space upgrade dash all, and that will upgrade everything on your computer so that it matches what is on that server. It will give you a choice too, you know, to kind of like, so if you're doing Slackware current, that's kind of the next step to get you to current. You do an upgrade all. So that's that. Now, you know how in like yum you've got, you know, yum search such and such, yum install such and such, yum remove so and so. And I'm sure you have, like on aptitude, you know, you've got aptitude remove, aptitude install, whereas aptitude uninstall, I'm not sure. But, you know, you've got different little commands that kind of piggyback onto that main invocation of your package management tool. Slackware, you sort of have that. You have a Slack package search, Slack package install, and I think you might even have a Slack package remove, I'm not sure. But you also have that install PKG and remove PKG. And you also have PKG tool, actually. So all of these little PKG tools are having to do with your package management. So if you've got a local file that you want to install, like a .tgz, that's a Slack package. Anything that's a .tgz is what a Slack package is. And so if you have a local file, rather than saying, you know, Slack package dash dash local, you know, install local or whatever, you just say install package space foobar.tgz, and that takes, or .txz, either one of those, and that will take that package and it, you know, it uncompresses it and puts it where it needs to go, and that's installed the package. You can do the same thing with remove PKG. Now, I'm not going to go with remove PKG yet because it's easier to probably tell you with a specific example. Luckily, I've got a specific example. And then you got a PKG tool as well, which is an incurses-based version of install PKG, remove PKG, and Slack PKG. It's kind of, it's more of a graphical way of doing those commands. But all those three or four commands are kind of your package management tools by default in Slackware. So use them wisely, use them often, use them well. So let's say, for instance, that, I don't know, we have a video driver problem. So if you're doing this on a MacBook, this might be a very apropos example for you. I installed it on my white and a black MacBook, and both times the video driver just wasn't working with the Intel card. So the first thing you have to do is remove the old driver. So everything that's been installed by the system is going to be it'll show up as a package that has been installed. And to see a list of all the installed packages, you could do a PKG tool and then view a list of all the installed packages. You can also find them in /var/log/packages. So that's what I often do. So I go to /var/log/packages, and then I do an ls, and maybe I'll grep with a -i switch for case insensitivity, and type in Intel. And that will bring me back a list of anything with Intel in it that's been installed. And sure enough, there'll be an xf86-intel-driver-2.2.8.tgz, let's say. I'm kind of making that up, but it's more or less that. So that's the new video driver that we need to get rid of because it's got a bug in it. So we say remove PKG and then the name of the driver, the path to that package. So it would be remove PKG .xf86-intel-video-driver-2.2.8.tgz. And it will remove that package from the system. So now if I were to start X, it would not know what to do because it has no video driver. So what we will do then is we'll go out to the CD drive and install an older version of that driver. Now the install CD, is, let's say, if you pop it into the drive, it won't be mounted yet, right? So you need to mount the CD drive. And again, you're root, so you can do all this pretty easily. So you'll simply type in mount space /dev/CD-ROM /media/CD-ROM. So you're just mounting the device CD-ROM to the /media/CD-ROM. And then you can CD into /media/CD-ROM and do an ls, and you'll see all the stuff on the Slackware ISO. Everything from the source packages to the extra directory. Oh, and the Slackbook directory. That's in there as well. So that's a handy read. Very good book by Mr. Alan Hicks, who I interviewed at Southeast Linux Fest, actually. So if you CD into the extras directory, you can find lots of things, actually. You can find, like, it'll say, like, extra video drivers. It'll say Wicked Wireless Manager, Emacs Speak. Lots of different things are in there. So what we'll need to do is install the older video driver. So you say, you know, well, you'd CD into the Intel video driver folder, and then you can say install PKG xf86-intel-video-driver 1.6.3.tgz, for instance. And it will take that package, local package from that directory, and install it onto your system. And it is just that simple. I mean, it's really quite easy. You could also do a package tool and choose install a package from the current directory and kind of do it that way. I don't bother. I don't really use package tool that much, PKG tool. But you can if you want to, and it is a nice little interface. I've used it before, and it does kind of make it easy to understand sometimes. But I don't know. I find that the command line versions are quite adequate for the way I work. Now, you can also install Wicked, WICD, which is the wireless network manager that is really, really good. And I'm trying to think if KDE even has a wireless manager at the point at 4.2. I don't think they do, actually. So I just use Wicked, and it really is a great little application. I mean, Dave Yates had talked about it on his podcast. I think Tilts had talked about it. You know, I'd heard about it, and I just kept resisting because I didn't think I needed it. But for whatever reason, I tried it out with Slackware 13, and now I'm completely addicted to it. So the thing that you're going to want to do there, again, it's in the extras directory, so you just cd into Wicked if you want, and then you do an install pkg wicked.tgz or whatever the name of the package is, and that'll install Wicked. Now, again, if you do an ls on /var/log/packages, you should see the new things that you've installed right there in /var/log/packages. So that's kind of package management in Slackware. Between /var/log/packages and things like PKG tool, install and remove PKG, and then Slack PKG itself, you've got quite a good little package manager, and it's just beautiful. It's all command line. It's intuitive. It's nice. I like it. Since we're talking about packages, also in the extras directory there is a grub package. So you can install grub. Slackware, of course, by default uses Lilo. Now, Lilo is nice because it can handle ext4, and as far as I know, and I could be wrong, grub cannot. Again, I could be wrong about that. I use Lilo anyway. But if you want to do like a dual boot thing and you need to install grub for some reason, then you can do that here in the extras directory. Again, just install pkg /grub.tgz or whatever it is, and that will install it. Now, you can do that, and that's fine. The thing to understand and remember is that when you're dual booting, a lot of people are going to rely, unfortunately, on auto detection. You know, the fact that your Ubuntu installer should just see that there's a Slackware partition and add that to its grub and make it work. And that doesn't always work that way, especially since Slackware by default does not use the init ram fs or whatever it is, the init ram disk, that's what it is. So this could be a problem sometimes, I think, for the auto detection systems. I don't think they quite know what to do without that little initial ram disk or whatever. I mean, I don't really know a whole lot about it. All I know is that it sometimes doesn't work. And for this reason, I typically simply add things manually to the bootloader. And I haven't done a grub entry in a while because I don't really use it that much. Or, again, if I do, a lot of times these are on systems that I'm not actually dual booting with, so I don't have to add anything manually because it just sets up the bootloader for me. But for grub, it would be, you know, your root would be parenthesis HD 0, comma, whatever, either 0 or 1 or 2, or, you know, wherever your partition is in your little scheme. So if you've got, let's say, Fedora on partition, on your first partition, and then Slackware on your second partition, you would want to go into Fedora and edit the grub menu so that, you know, you could label it Slackware, and then your root would be parentheses HD 0, comma, 1, parentheses, because remember we're dealing with computer numbers here and they start with 0. So 0, comma, 0 would be the Fedora partition. 0, comma, 1 would be the Slackware one. And then the boot, what you would boot to is /boot/vm/linux, L-I-N-U-Z, as in Z. So that's the kernel image. And the way that Slackware does it is that it just it symlinks VM Linux to whatever current kernel you're running. So when you do a custom compile, you one of the last steps that you do is you symlink VM Linux to that new kernel that you've just compiled. So it's really it's an easy entry compared to some other things I find. And I guess the only, I don't know, I can't think of really that many reasons you'd want to install grub on your Slackware partition, although I'm sure a lot of people have a good reason and will probably email me telling me exactly why they would want to do that. I'm fine with Lilo, so I don't really bother with grub, but that's grub. So just remember that, you know, your bootloader is going to be whatever you're installing. I mean, probably it's going to install grub or Lilo to your master boot record. So if you know that you're dual booting Slackware with another system, like, so if, again, if I've got Fedora on my first partition and then Slackware on my second, when I'm installing Slackware, there's a place in the installer that I forgot to mention where it asks you, okay, do you want me to install Lilo? Well, you could just skip that. Say, no, don't install Lilo. And then you can, or you could say, yes, install Lilo, but to the beginning of this partition. Do not do it to the MBR. And then you can set in your grub exactly, you know, for Fedora, exactly where that second OS is on the second partition and everything, and just let that partition kind of be a almost a self-contained little environment. So that's probably what I would do. I think I would typically just add it manually rather than try to let something auto-detect the system. The MBR, of course, being the master boot record, meaning that it's like that little tiny space at the beginning of the actual drive, the actual hard drive that you bought at the store. There's a little master boot record that the BIOS knows, I'm going to look at this first, so that's like right up there. And then, you, of course, there are ways to install your bootloaders to simply the beginning of the partitions, but you have to still understand that that MBR is the big master grub place. That's got the bootloader in it, and that's going to kind of look at the whole disk it's going to see everything. It sees all partitions. And if you have another bootloader on the partition, that bootloader, that master boot record, will see that bootloader. So you kind of just want to make sure that you're installing not too many bootloaders, and certainly that you're not overwriting the bootloader that you actually want to use in the MBR. So you're basically done at this point. I mean, you've got your users established, you've got your little Slack PKG configured, and you've got some extra things like a good video driver or a good network manager or possibly a different bootloader installed. At this point, there's not a whole lot left to do other than, I guess, if you want to start X and do stuff, you can, or you don't have to, and you can continue using your system in your text console. Doesn't really matter to me. But to start X, you would simply type in start X, and that will, again, invoke whatever X is that you had defined when you were installing. So if you'd said default to KDE, then you're going to see KDE starting up and hopefully getting through the entire startup, and then so you'll be dropped in the default desktop of KDE 4.2.4 or whatever. If you need to change that, you know, if for instance, I do have a different user for my multimedia tasks. So I might log in as a different user and then start X as that user. But instead of starting X for that multimedia user so that I'm starting KDE, which is going to take up a lot of my available RAM, and I don't have that much RAM, so I need to kind of use that sparingly, I'll set Fluxbox as my initial, as my .x init rc. So to do that, you just, in your home directory, you just vim.xinitrc and make it say exec space slash user slash bin slash start fluxbox. I'm pretty sure that's the correct path, but you get the idea. So you make it such that the xinitrc points to a different start x environment than what the default is. And that will, you know, when you say start x, it will automatically look in your home directory first for a customized xinitrc rather than using the system default. So you can do that. K KDE will really take care of most of the specifics for you. I mean, in terms of, like, you know, configuring your computer to act like a normal computer, all that hard work has been done by the KDE people already. You don't really have to do anything in terms of setting up Slackware, you know. I mean, it's all there. You installed the applications when you did the Slackware install, and you installed KDE, so KDE is going to take care of, you know, when you put a disk in, it's going to be detected by KDE, and it's going to offer to mount that volume for you, or it's going to be detected by XFCE and be auto-mounted, or whatever environment you're using. A lot of that kind of stuff is just taken care of by the desktop environment, so it's not like you have to sit there and learn how to be a programmer to configure your system, as you can tell. It's really, I mean, as you can tell, it's not that complex. I don't know exactly why people give Slackware such a bum rap for being, you know, difficult to install or difficult to use. I'm really not sure where that comes from. So, yeah, that's Slackware for you. Now, of course, there is a really, really handy little application called SBO PKG, which, in my mind, is so significant and so neat and so cool that it really deserves its own little episode. So I'm gonna do SBO PKG and just some things about Slack builds in general next episode, episode 17 of season 4. So you can stay, expect that very, very soon. And other than that, I think that's about all I've got to say about Slackware. And that's about it. That's all I've got for you. If you want to email me, it's klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org or klaatu@linuxcranks.info. They both go to the same inbox, so feel free to clutter that up. You can go to the website, thebadapples.info. You can find me on IM as notklaatu@jabber.org. That's a Jabber account, so you'll need to probably interface with some IM client that accepts Jabber. So, you can also find me on IRC on Freenode, usually in, for instance, pound Linux cranks, pound lot of Linux links, pound Slackware, pound a couple other things, I forget what, but yeah, so you can find me there, so feel free to chat sometime. And thanks for listening, and thanks for the feedback, and I will talk to you next time.